Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Hugh Off the Record. We have a special one today. We turned 21. It's the 21st episode. And I want to thank you all for the support on the pod so far. Hopefully, you're enjoying everything we're putting out. I'm trying to get interesting people to speak with. We couldn't do it without you, though. So I want to thank you guys for tuning in, subscribing, tweeting, Instagramming, Facebooking, if that's a verb. Now, our very special guest today is Sergeant Brian Wood of the Princess of Wales Royal Regiment. He's a member of a very small group of British soldiers. Now, since the Falklands War, only one time have soldiers fixed bayonets before going into combat. Now, this happened in Iraq in a battle called the Battle of Danny Boy. Now, you may have heard about this earlier this year. As if the battle itself wasn't enough, some so-called human rights lawyer named Phil Shiner took it upon himself to falsely claim details about the battle. Now, thankfully, this charlatan idiot was finally exposed, but sadly, the damage had already been done. So without further ado, I want to give you an amazing story by an amazing man, an inspirational man, and a hero, the recipient of the Military Cross, telling the story of the Battle of Danny Boy in his own words.
Hi, Dan Hewitt.
It's BA, mate. It's good to be talking with you. And as a vet, I think it's important, and I always do this in my podcast, I always try to talk to guys that have served their country, and they have a unique perspective on stuff. And one of the things that struck me when I first started reading about you was that you were accused of some crazy stuff after you probably did one of the most heroic things that a military man could do. And it just seemed like it was bizarre to me. And the fact that it got traction was what we were just talking about before I hit the red button. So, I mean, what happened with it? You said you were away on a course?
Yeah, so if I'll give you an insight of that day, really. It was it was 14th of May, 2004. And it was 14:30 hours where we had just been hit with the most violent of ambushes. You know, I'd been fighting.
Yeah, you're in Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like the uprising as well. So just before that happened, there was a jihad which was called, and there was an uprising from the start of our tour all the way until it finished. Basically, the main militia leader just wanted all coalition forces to be hit and to be hit hard. So, you know, being in an ambush, it wasn't of a surprise, but what this was overly surprising because of how violent it was. And basically the militia force, 20 of them, had gone into these sort of pre-dug trench positions, dug them out, dug them deeper, and they were staying and fighting. Good. But I was in the back of a vehicle, so I was disorientated. It was 55 degrees, sweat pouring off me. And I was in the back as a dismount commander. The gunner and the commander then were engaging the enemy. They were, you know, having an exchange, we were trying to win the firefight. And then 10, 15 minutes into that exchange,
we have an M50 on the top of that thing too, right?
30 mil.
Well, yeah. So whoever's there, whoever you're shooting at is pretty determined if they're not running away from that. I mean,
and the reason why they wanted boots on the ground was because they were in this trench type system where they were just being opportunists. They were engaged, and one point to the other, exactly that. So it was hard for us to, you know, fix and destroy. So then the call came, which was, "Woody, prepare to fix bayonets get out the back of this vehicle.
That's like World War II shit, though. I mean, I was a Marine, right? I don't think I ever, I learned how to put my bayonet on in like infantry school, you know, but I don't think I've ever actually kind of practiced doing it.
I mean, exactly. I mean, we do something in training called bayonet fighting when you do a whole morning of it.
You kind of like go back and forth kind of thing, but you don't really think much of it at that point, right?
You don't ever think that one day I will be doing this for real, close quarters, arms distance away.
And you were a corporal then?
A lance corporal.
Yeah, man, well, Lance corporal. All right, so it's like, you know, hello. You know?
23 years old. Man. And I was a young commander, so I had responsibilities. And once that call came to fix bayonets and prepare to get out of that vehicle, you know, my heart was beating off my body armor plate. I could hear it, like, smashing against it with adrenaline. And I was like, I kind of done them emoji eyes. When he asked me the commander, I was like, bloody hell, are you... Yeah, but I obviously didn't question his judgment, but I asked him to say it again because it's not a command you get told to do.
Yeah, you don't hear fixed bayonets in modern armies, man.
This is it. And I asked him, I said, can you say again the command? He said, listen, prepare you and your men to fix bayonets and get out this vehicle and launch a full frontal attack. So then I tuned in and I was asking him key questions, enemy strengths, which was 20, and there was three of us initially, so I was like, we're pretty outnumbered, but we'll commit.
Yeah.
What weapon systems have they got? They had PKMs, AK-47s, RPGs, the traditional weapon systems that has, you know, that they use. I asked him for some sort of location on the ground because I couldn't see because I was in the back of the vehicle.
Yeah. So how do the doors open?
It's an armoured vehicle, right. I was in, so it's like it's
because sometimes the Bradleys go down, some go sideways.
They go sideways. So this is a hydraulic.
So it's slow, right?
Yeah, they're not too slow. I mean, they come out pretty rapid because they're built for dismount close quarter combat. So I mean, they come out pretty quick. So yeah, like I said, I made sure that the guys knew everything that we needed to achieve, and I just wanted to lead by example. So I went out first, and like I should do, because I was a young commander and I was a leader of men. And I really, to be honest, hoped for the best, and I just wanted to give myself the best opportunity for me and my guys on the ground to at least do an estimate process on how I'm going to get from here, where I am now in the open, to that trench and try and survive. And I remember when the door opened, it was so bright, like, it made my eyes squint, my heart was racing, the sand flew in my eyes from the wind, and then I just committed. I just got out of that vehicle, and the British values and standards and courage, and just went, you know, and just committed and got out. And it was so loud because the vehicle was firing us in at this point.
So you're just having shots going over your head.
Coming, like, close as well. I was like, shit. And I managed to we got out, and three of us fammed out, and then I tried to sort of calm myself and compose myself, because at this point I hadn't seen where the enemy trench
you just
was.
Hit the first cover
I just
found,
hit
right,
the first bit of cover to give us a chance, and then I composed myself, told the guys, made sure that everyone was okay, and said I was going to go up like a little meerkat and have a little peer to just try and get eyes on the enemy so I could start doing this planning process. Then from nowhere, we were joined by another two British soldiers from a different platoon. And I was like, all right, lads.
Yeah, let's get to see some friends. Yeah.
Said, listen, right, there's five of us now. This is what we're going to do. I've seen the enemy. They're about 120 metres away from us, and they were fighting hard against the vehicle. Because when we got out, it was a bit of a deception, because the armoured vehicle really rained down on this position.
Yeah.
They had their heads down.
So they didn't see you guys
come out. But I knew once we exposed ourselves, we were then in a two-way kinetic engagement, and it was going to be violent because we were only 100 metres away at this point.
And they've dug in.
They're staying and fighting. Yeah. They are staying and fighting, which I knew anyway. So I'd done a peered over like a meerkat, seen this defensive position that they were dug into, and it was over-violent. And I was thinking, do you know what? I don't think we might have much of a chance, but I knew my intent. I knew my mission command.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to commit regardless. And I said to the guys, when I give them the brief, because there was no way we could go right flanking or left flanking. It was a old school World War II material, up over the top, and you just go and you work hard with aggression and some of the values that we've grown up with, and just really be determined. And I said to the guys, once we commit, we don't go back.
Mm.
We bound forward and we just try and take the initiative, and we work hard and we fight hard together. And how are we going to do it? We're going to go and do it in two stages. So I will go first with another guy. It was me and Rushforth. We got up, and we were bound forward. Once we start engaging, then you, so we had one foot on the ground at all times. So we pepper potted and bounded, you know, and leapfrogged each other. And I was like, okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And that was it. We got ourselves up. As soon as we go, I reckon, you know, when I took my first kneeling position to engage, I was in a two-way dust up then. Damn. It was kinetic, and it was like that sort of shit going past you.
Yeah, yeah, you started hitting the bees buzzing.
Absolutely, it was as well. It's like the bees are buzzing around me. I think at any time now, I'm going to hear man down, or I'm going to get hit myself. But I was just so determined to achieve what we set out to do. You know, these are very, very violent people, and they were militia fighters.
And they weren't going anywhere, like they said. They were there to the death, yeah.
They were there. I thought they weren't going anywhere. However, when I was closing with and getting closer and closer, and I then could start to see bodies in and around the position, dead bodies that had been hit by us and been hit by the vehicles, giving us support. Because we started to become effective,
yeah.
They started to kind of like get
they lost their
and
nerve,
they
yeah.
lost their nerve. And they started to, some of them started to withdraw back, get out of the position and start falling back. And I was like, we've got the upper hand here. Just keep going, keep going. Yes. As we're into our last bound position, just about to go in and spray and do the last bits that we do is when we close and destroy, all of a sudden they threw their weapons down and surrendered. So we had to go from like a split second decision making, which was full violent. It's very hard to do, but we did it. And we did it. And the boys in my regiment, who I love so much, we did it with the highest integrity and we saved their lives because they surrendered and we did not. Take action on that.
And the ironic thing was, if by any chance those roles were reversed, they wouldn't have spared you guys. They probably wouldn't have spared you for more than a second. You know what I mean?
We know that. Yeah. That's 100% fact.
So with this all happening, right, this is an incredible, what is it, 15 minutes of your life, probably the most intense 15 minutes any man could probably understand. You know what I'm saying? I find it hard to understand. Mm. And you have to go from 100 miles an hour to zero in a matter of seconds when these guys throw their weapons down. It's over because that's the values that you were instilled in by your commanders and stuff. That's heavy.
It's a big ask. It really is.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see how it sometimes does go wrong because when you're, you know, it's how I explain it. It's kind of an out-of-body experience because I never thought I was going to do hand-to-hand combat. Mm-hmm. You know, this stuff is old school stuff.
Yeah, they train us with rifles, man, for a reason. It's go a long way, man.
And I mean, I was then heading towards a heavily defended, outgunned and outnumbered trench. And then, yeah, like I said, they surrendered. We then stopped engaging. We then took them as prisoner of war. So, you know, we disarmed them. We made sure that they were plastic cuffed and separated from the enemy dead. So, because we don't do that because... You know, Geneva Convention, we don't mix them up. We've done it all by the standards and try to adhere to the gold standard rule.
Yeah.
So we did that. And then my sergeant major appeared from nowhere and was like, Woody, at this point, I was sweating and really exhausted.
Yeah, just, like I said,
and couldn't really believe what I'd just done.
Just
yeah.
out. You feel like you're going to flap apart.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just about to have that moment of sitting down where he's like, Woody, is the battlefield clear? And I was like, shit, because I knew it wasn't clear. And for a split second, I didn't want to go through again what I'd just experienced because it was like something I wouldn't want to experience again. It was. And I was like, no, it's not, sir. And he said, right, you're going to come with me. We're going to work in a pairs and we're going to go and clear this space, the battle area of the area of operations in front of us. Mm-hmm. Okay, you happy with that? And this is my sergeant major. This is who I looked up to. This guy's a legend. Yeah, I mean, I'm like, all right, let's go. And then sure enough, we started pepper potting. In the first 20 meters, two guys, AK-47s, just bung their weapons to bear. I dropped to a knee. But this was like, this was 10 meter engagement stuff. Yep. And then I put two to his chest. I think I put a couple to his guts. He dropped down and the other one dropped down. And I was like, chest head to the sergeant major, fucking hell. He's like, targets down, move. And didn't even give me a chance to sort of, he was just like, move. And then I moved again. And it was close quarter CQB lanes. So it's just going up. And then sure enough, another 20 meters, we could hear noises. They stood up with an RPG. My sergeant major engaged him and engaged another guy who stood up with a PKM ready to fire from the hip.
And these are like rocket propelled grenades for people who don't know.
Yeah, right.
And big old machine guns. Yeah, I mean, lost big old 7.62s at you. Yeah.
Which will take, you know, they'll tear you to pieces. Yeah. If you're here, you're torn apart. I mean,
You get shot.
Yeah, the caliber is you know, so intense. And, yeah, like I said, we bounded another bound and another two guys come up and we both, at the same time, engaged these two militia fighters. And then I said to the Sergeant Major, you know, we're vulnerable here. And he said, absolutely, what, we're going to go back. You move first. As I've moved, I've got down. As he's then moved to join me, from the corner of my eye, I see something. As I've turned, it was two militia fighters stood up and they threw their weapons down. So that played on my head quite a lot because I thought, why didn't they just kill us? I mean, our backs were turned.
Yeah.
They could have just engaged us and just were done with us. But they didn't. So then I kind of didn't dwell on it too long. And then we arrested them, took them to the main position. And talking about, you know, humanity, on the way back, we've got our medics working on one of the militia fighters. You know, he's got a chest seal on. He's giving him CPR. Mm-hmm. He's putting another one on a drip. But none of this gets reported, right?
Of course it does. I mean, everybody expects perfect. I mean, you also look at it like normal civilian people. If someone scares them in a hallway or scares them when they walk into their room, they freak out. And their initial reaction after they realize that they're not going to die for being scared, they want to punch you or something. Yeah. It's a reaction. Yeah. Kind of, you got so scared, you got angry.
Yeah.
For you, you didn't get, you were scared, you were angry, but you didn't let that affect the situation. That's,
I think, you're absolutely right, and we can't afford to let it affect the situation. To be honest, you know, I had never been in a position like that before, so I was testing myself to a degree, but I was testing myself to the extreme because, I've returned fire, I've engaged when we were in urban, and we were doing urban operations and urban fighting, but not close and personal like this.
And also, you're with your Sergeant Major.
Absolutely.
So like, I've had Sergeant Major, they're like my dad.
Yeah. I mean, this guy's a hero to me. Yeah. He is the most inspirational, or one of the most inspirational men, you know, I know to this day.
And you don't want
to
let him down, you don't want to let your guys down. I mean, that's the whole idea, why you composed yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, so these guys that you arrested, how did this all get turned around?
So basically, this crazy call we got on the battlefield. So we went to the main position. There was so much movement now because people had arrived on the battle scene. There was a lot of bodies on the ground and direction. And basically, I got back to the main sort of reorganization position. And that was when a call was made by brigade. So real high up was to extract all the bodies from the battlefield, load them up into the vehicles and take them back to our main camp base.
And that's something you do all the time. Yeah, you never bring enemy bodies. It's always you take your own. But
take your own with all costs.
Can I interrupt for a second? So no British troops, none of your guys were hurt during this. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely, you know, I'm not religious or heavily religious in any shape, way or form, but, you know, I believe there had to be someone looking down on us that day because the amount that, you know, how close were the sand in front of my feet, it was pepper pot and it was spraying up and the noise past my ears and the soldiers' ears. I was just waiting and it just never happened for some remarkable reason. It was just,
There's no atheists on a battlefield, they say, what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So this call was made and this later on in life really played with my mindset because taking another human being's life, you know, in warfare, you know, it happens. You take the enemy's life, but to then go back and to pick them up when you've taken their lives. So then, you know, and these bodies were hit with some ferocious ammunition and that they were disfigured and, you know, and it just didn't sit right. And, you know, leading by example, the decision was made. The first body I went to, I picked up myself and just said, look, Begsy, another guy on the ground, said, we need to move these, mate. And he's like, and then the other guy, JC, is being violently sick because there were not pretty scenes, and he was, and I just said, look, you go and have a rest. Let us get a hold of these bodies. Anyway, fast forwarding, we load the bodies on, and then we had a different vehicle for the POWs because we don't mix them up, clearly. And then we headed back to camp, but on the way back to camp, the vehicles broke down, all the Challenger battle tanks. We had a big battle tank join us, which leveled, like, it fired over my head and leveled their sort of, they had a depth position, but it fired over my head and leveled this depth position.
Yeah, tanks, it's
like,
insane.
I mean, this is like a 120 Hesh high explosive thing come over my head. It was like, fucking hell. That broke down. So then we had to wait around for another sort of an hour and 45 minutes. By this time, the smell and, you know, you can only imagine what was leaking into this vehicle, which is all plugged because of the oil and stuff. So they have like these access plugs, which were plugged, and you can only imagine that. And then we eventually got back to our camp, and there was a lot of people moving, and because this has like never been done before, this was like proper crazy stuff. And there's a lot of people ready to process the POWs, which are prisoner of war. And when I got out of the vehicle, they were like, Woody, you need to go up and to the regimental aid post. The doctor's there waiting, and then you need to unload the bodies onto the bodies bags. I was like, okay, no problem. So I went up there. By this point, you know, I was covered in blood myself from movement of the bodies, and like I'm head to toe covered as well. Got to there, seen the doctor, and he's like, right, okay, you need to open up the vehicles and start laying these bodies out. So I thought, lads, right, this is what we need to do, give them some clear direction. And then I couldn't believe it was about to happen next.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So the back door, because it's an armoured back door, it's on a hydraulic system. Mm-hmm. So when you press the button, it hydraulically moves the heavy door out. So when we pressed the button, there was nothing. It was dead. The vehicle was not responding, so the door wouldn't open. The only way to open that door is to climb through the turret over the bodies and do it manually.
Oh, man.
So I was like, right, after 4.5 hours of fighting and experience with doing what we did with the bodies to get them back to camp, who is going to do that? I didn't really want to do it.
Really?
The soldiers don't want to do it. So I was like, lads, we're just going to have to bit of British black humour, as we call it. You know, we're just going to have to play paper, scissors, stones.
Yeah, the Marines do that too.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we did. I mean, it's like, you know, rock, scissors, stones, rock, scissors. Anyway, it was a driver which unfortunately, you know, lost, and he had a head torch on. He's like, just talk to me, just reassure me. So we were reassuring him, saying you're all right, a bit of banter, flying and pooing and throwing like you do. Make him kind of like laugh in the face of adversity, really, because this is like really honking stuff that we're doing.
I don't think anybody who's listening to this could possibly imagine. First of all, dead bodies, when you see them in films and things like that, they have like a bullet hole, there's some blood. But people's, the bowels go, I mean, there's piss, there's shit, there's blood. It's nasty.
It's
fucking horrible.
Out there.
And this guy's got to go through. These guys have just lugged all this back into the thing.
So he's climbing through this. But what had happened on the battlefield, one of the soldiers didn't check one of the militias who was classed as dead. They never checked his pulse. So what he did, he played dead. So we loaded them onto this vehicle as dead, but he was alive, right? So when he was doing this, when he was hand cranking this door open, he looked, and then sure enough, sat bolt right. He sat up bolt right, and he was screaming, and he just sort of opened the back door enough so he could get out sideways, and he got out and he ran.
This is the insurgent dude, right?
The insurgent dude who we thought was dead.
Dead is alive and running in your camp now.
Nah. He set up.
Oh,
bolt rock, your guy. And the guy, yeah. Like, the British soldier got out and ran, screaming, "He's alive, he's alive." And I was like, "What?" Sure enough, I've looked in there. He's looking at me. He just ran, just stare off. And I was like, "Oh, my God." So I've then got him out, went through the whole process of arresting him and taking him away.
And is he wounded?
Gunshot wound to the leg. You know?
So he's shocked out.
And he's shocked out. And he just looked at me, not even muttering a word, just looked at me and made a stare off. And I was thinking, "Oh, my God, this is outrageous." So we managed to take him out. We arrested him. He then went through the process of that, of the chain of command on there. And then that was like a talking point. We managed to get the bodies all laid out, and then we were just about to start cleaning the vehicle when the medics came over. A lot of medics came over and was like, "Would it? You and your men need to stand down. Stand down, we'll clean the vehicles out," because we were fucked, to be honest. We were fatigued, we were exhausted. And to be honest, we were kind of like shocked ourselves on what we'd just conducted and what we'd just been through.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, even through combat operations, you at certain points, you're not expected to pick up the people that you have just engaged and killed and then put them back in your vehicle in this extreme situation and all this. It usually breaks down in different
forces. Yeah, absolutely.
Was it force service support people
that's coming up,
right?
Yeah. So all of this had happened and my headspace was like, doing overtime at this point. And I went in the shower and I remember just turning the shower on and, you know, the grit and the sand and the blood was just rinsing off me into the plug hole. And I was leaning against the wall, just really couldn't believe what had just happened. And then the tour continued. So the next day we're back out in the city fighting.
You're patrolling again.
Yeah, absolutely fighting, because it was a really intense tour. But I had to come home a month early from the tour because I was earmarked to go on a promotional course. And if you miss it, it slips quite along. So I didn't want to go because I'd been fighting hard. Previous to that, I was blown up. You know, luckily I had all my limbs. But so we had been fighting hard, and I've been a lot, you know, I've been with my men a long time. So I didn't want to leave them early and go home. But I was basically ordered, "Doesn't matter, you're going." So I was like, okay. So I left Alamara in Iraq. And I didn't have any decompression. I went from that location straight back to home, going through my front door. And I left my son, he was 3 weeks old, and I left him to go to Iraq. So I left as a young, lovable father who was so excited to come back and see my newborn son and Lucy, who had obviously done a remarkable job taking care of him while I was away. And I got back. And I couldn't process it. I couldn't process it. And, you know, I was sort of struggling, if I'm honest, with the whole, you know, I didn't know how to be a dad. And I would hold him, he would cry. I'd bath him, he would cry. I'd read him a story, he would cry. I would try and feed him, he would cry. And it just wasn't sitting well with me. And I had so much anger built up inside of me. I didn't really know what to do, if I'm honest. And like, Lucy was coaching me and advising me and really sticking by me. And my reaction was just to be angry with her, put her down. The way I spoke to her was not necessary, because she was just trying to help. But I just didn't know what to do. I was in this unknown position where I was failing and failing fast. And I just didn't know how to be at home. And I remember making a bottle for baby to feed him, and apparently it was too hot. She said, "Oh, it's too hot." And I just turned around and threw it against the kitchen wall and just said, "Do you know what? You just fucking do it then, because I can't. I just don't know what to do. I can't do this." And it just sort of kind of spiraled. And then I was home for 4 days, and my phone rang, and I answered it, and it was rear operations camp sergeant major. He said to me, "Woody, is everything okay?" So I thought something had been said that I've come home. And I mean,
yeah, you should be throwing bottles around the kitchen,
I thought someone had said something. I thought, no one knows. So I said, "Yeah, I'm fine, absolutely." He said, "All right, we've got an issue." I said, "Oh, what's wrong, sir?" He said, "Chris Raymond's been killed in action." He wasn't killed in action, sorry. And it was an accidental death where he'd been hit by a barrier. A vehicle was leaving. He was basically on security.
He was on guard duty. One of those big cement jammies.
Oh. It caught the wire and slammed on his head. But I knew him quite well. We played football. He was a Mel Charlton athletic fan. And I couldn't believe after that tempo of that operation that he'd lost his life like that. And he said to me, "We want you to be burial party and repatriate him." So that was, I had only been home for 4 days. I was like struggling with the whole family life. Absolutely, I was going to do that because he needs the best send off that we can give him as a British soldier. So I was like, "Sir, I'll do that, no problem. I will carry that weight and I'll carry it with dignity for him." So we went. I said to Lucy, "I've got to go." She's like, "Okay, totally respect that. It's fine." So we had to go away for 3 days and we'd done loads of rehearsals and drills and stuff. And then we went to Bryce Norton where the big Hercules was flying into. And I was composed and I was ready. I thought I was ready to, like, you know, really be non-emotional and just, you know, do what I had to do.
Yeah, the military bearing, right?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we're professional and we need to give him the best send-off, but I'm only human and I've got emotion and I'm not a robot. So when I seen this hurt came in, I sort of gritted my teeth and thought, right, let's focus, come on, and just do as best as we can for him. And we slow marched onto the ramp and it was, you know, the Union Jack was draped over the coffin. And what they do on the plane, they don't go above the headspace because the plaque, they don't disrespect the plaque at first, so they show it. So when we marched on, his plaque with his name, when he was born and when he passed, was on the plaque. And I remember saying to myself, and I was in the middle of the body, so there was two either side of me, and then me in the middle, and then opposite was the other three. Yeah. And I remember saying to myself, "Don't look at the plaque, don't look at the plaque." And then, of course, you look at the plaque. And that kind of set me off a bit. I gritted my teeth, and then tears started to stream down my face, and I was a little bit emotional then, and then my sergeant major said, "Right now," because it wasn't just me, it was the other guys, you know, which had emotion. He's like, "Listen, get yourself together now, prepare to lift." You know, and we did that, and we lifted, and we done the right turn, and we walked down the ramp, and as we started walking towards the hearse, you could see his family, and I mean, his mum was wailing for him, and it was hard, hard, really hard. And, you know, we did that, and then we laid him into the ground when we got to the cemetery. You know, it was a really difficult day for me. And then I got home, didn't speak about it to Lucy. She didn't really know what to say to me, so she left me alone. But then I kind of said, you know, "Why aren't you even asking me how I am?" And she couldn't really win with me. Yeah, you know, she couldn't win with me. But I think this maybe was the start of, yeah, PTSD, maybe my mental health issues. We've gone from one extreme to the next.
A lot of guys, we bottle stuff up because we don't want to burden our lives and stuff like that. And I think with that, that's I think a problem that we all have.
Yeah.
That once we get past that, and we can start talking to other guys about what we go through, it lessens the burden. It's not just all on us. Because I imagine you probably thought you were absolutely alone, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. The thing is, I felt I was a leader of men. You know, I was an infantry soldier. Mm-hmm. I was a frontline trained soldier. And people looked up to me within my regiment. So for me to even try and contemplate going to see someone was like, no way. I thought it was a sign of weakness. But yeah, I was weak.
Yeah, well,
for not going out and seeing someone.
Guess, but you know, you impress on me the fact that a lot of times we mistake our emotions for us being weak.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, all the other guys were emotional too. I mean, it's something that, you know, I think sometimes our bearing gets the best of us. And as a Marine, I know there were times where I had to do the whole stiff upper lip thing and not show any emotion. Yeah. And then later you realize that that was probably a step in the wrong direction.
Definitely. So I got home, and then I was prepping my kit, ready to go to Wales, to the Brecon Beacons, to go on this course, which was another 4 month course. So I was only home for a short time to then go away for another 4 months. And my phone rang again. and Leo Callahan was shot and killed in Basra, and I was asked to repatriate him. So I had to go through that whole emotional cycle again, which absolutely I wanted to do. I said, I'll do it again because he deserves this, absolutely. But it was just, my head was all over the place at this point, and I kind of just was just parking all of these experiences and this trauma stuff, just parking it in my headspace and not speaking about it, and never spoke about it. And that was such an emotional day again. And then I got home, and as crazy as it sounds, and I know this is maybe a little bit selfish, but I'm going to be honest, because, you know, it's, you have to be,
it is what it is.
But I felt happier going on a military course than I did at home, because I didn't know how to be at home.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to do it, and there was no rule book. And I was like, you know, I was failing. I was hurting Lucy. I didn't know how to be at home.
Did you feel like you being home was worse for your family than you being away?
Do you know, that's a good question. I'd have to even ask Lucy. Lucy would answer that. Yeah,
because a lot of times I find with guys I talk to, and in my personal life as well, I thought me being home caused more problems than me being away. You know,
and because thing is, women are unbelievable and they're resilient. Mm-hmm. So when I went away, Lucy got into a routine.
Yeah.
She knew exactly what she was doing from when she woke up to when she put Bailey to bed, and she got it. When I came, I started to like sort of, hang on a minute, messing up her routine. I put my bags at the door. I've kicked my boots off, my military boots at the door, and she's asked me to put them away. And I'm like, fucking really? In the whole scheme of things, what I've been doing, you're asking me, just moaning me about my boots being there. Yeah. I mean, come on. But yeah, like I said, I just, and that was me. I went on this course, and
That was the commando course.
Right? This was my course to become
NCO,
a full corporal. Yeah. So it was a very demanding
NCO school.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. A very demanding physical and mental course. But this is where, when I was on course, this is where the whole sort of the start. The nothing was announced, but it kind of started.
Mm.
Now, for me, thinking back, it started because I was in a weapon lesson. We were in there as a team. The instructor was there showing us how to take a lesson on weapon systems. When a knock at the door, the door was opened, and it was two Special Investigation Branch Regiment, RMPs, Regimental Military Police, in their civvies, in their suits, and they said, I want to speak to Lance Corporal Wood. And my instructor was like, he's in a lesson, what do you want him for? I was, oh, and we need to question him on the Battle of Danny Boy. And I was like, random. Anyway, just, I was a young guy, didn't take any representation with me because I didn't know the rules and regulations. I just went.
You go sit down and answer questions. Yeah. Man,
I do what I'm told. I mean, these people are senior to me, and I just do what I'm told. So they took me out of our barracks, which we were in, took me to a different barracks, took me to a room, sat me in front of a computer screen, and they said, right, the reason why you're here is we want to question you on your statements that you gave after the Battle of Danny Boy, and we want you to identify the bodies and the POWs. Bearing in mind, I'm trying to concentrate on this career course.
Yeah, this is something completely happened to you a long time ago. Frankly, you probably don't remember every guy's face, right?
Of course you don't. Yeah. You don't. And I said to them, I don't know. And they said, well, we need to go through this. This is a process. And I was like, this is a random process. Like, bearing in mind, I'm trying to be focused for this career course.
Mm.
Now my head is all over the place again. Then they're asking me about some discrepancies in my statement, and things were highlighted, and they asked me to look at these photographs of these different bodies and all sorts. And I was like, this is just crazy. And obviously I did it, went back to camp, and then just tried to crack on with a course, which I did. And then, you know, 3 years after that course.
Wait, 3 years?
Yeah, after that course, I was on my commando course.
All right, this is crazy. Yeah. 3 years after these guys kind of...
Yeah. Yeah.
Pick your brain for something that you don't really remember.
Yeah. No. And then I was on my commando course. I'd just done the bottom field assault course, the 30-foot rope climb, came back to the room, and then I had a missed call on my phone. It's from Lucy, and she never phones me because she knows the score.
Mm-hmm.
So I phoned her back, and she said, oh, there's a really, really important letter here. I said, well, open it and read it. And she opened it, and it went silent. I said, oh, are you there? Lucy, she was like, I don't believe it. She said, there's a letter here that is announcing there's going to be a public inquiry regarding the Battle of Danny Boy, and the allegations are murder, mutilation and mistreatment of POWs. And I've asked her, I said, is it my name? Is my name on there? She said, yes, it's your name, Brian. It's your name. It's you. You've got to go and have interviews of the start of this process. And I'm on a course. I'm on a commanding course. And I'm like, and it's, you know, to own your Green Beret is demanding. As you know, as a former Marine, I mean, it's a graft. So now my headspace is all over the place. Why are they murder? I mean, this is the most serious of allegations.
Yeah, and you can almost smell the civilian and all that. You know, where it's like mutilation, murder, you know.
And the thing is, I mean, none of that happened. I mean, I was just like, this is just crazy. But then sure enough, it grew traction. Then it was in the press. Then it was in the British media. Then, do you know what?
The British media, frankly, is some of the biggest bottom feeders when you go and see some of the stuff that they come up with.
It's hurtful.
Especially at the anti-forces thing.
Yeah, it's super hurtful, but it really is, because I just, as a young 23-year-old, I thought I did the best that I could possibly do, and we got out of there alive, you know? And with, I thought, my integrity at the highest level, because my values are very high, and this started to really affect me. And then,
what rank are you at this point when you're doing the course?
Sergeant.
Because you're a full sergeant now.
Yeah.
You were a Lance Corporal before.
Yeah, at the time. Yeah.
What is it, 6 years, you say?
Five. It was five.
5 years.
When I got, yeah. I mean, I just couldn't sort of believe that this had come out in the media without me sitting down with anyone and really explaining my side of the story. It just came out, and it was like, aired to the public, and my name was in the press. And like, I was at a bar. I remember once I was in a bar in Farnham in Surrey, and a friend came up to me and said, Brian, did you do it? And it hurt me so much, because then I had to justify myself. And I thought, why am I justifying myself?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what hurt the most. Friends and family would ask, you know, did that happen? It's like, it didn't happen.
So were the allegations that the guys that were fighting you got killed?
No, they said that we took them back alive and then executed them against the wall.
And who's the guy with he is like yellow?
Yeah, Phil Shiner.
Who is this dude? And why do people listen to this?
I mean, I had many a sleepless nights asking me myself that same question. You know, he's a British guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's gone over there and taken cases on for these Iraqi military fighters, militia fighters, who have caused the British soldiers and American soldiers so much heartache. Yeah. Someone is taken. I get it. If you do something and it is illegal, it has to be looked into. But there was no evidence, nothing, that this was illegal to then go into the public domain.
And when you told me the story earlier, there are the five guys that were all assaulting with you. You have your sergeant major as well.
Yep.
You have the commander and the gunner from the
driver.
Vehicle.
Yeah.
And then you got the medics. You got the two vehicles. You got the tankers.
Yeah.
So all these guys are now
they're in
on this conspiracy.
They're in it. They're in it. They're all in it. There was a hell of a lot of us. I'm just obviously for mine and me and you sat here. It's I can tell you how my feelings and how I felt. But there was so many more people who it affected. You know, you're talking about careers were ruined and ended. Marriages were ruined and ended. Mine close, very close to shattering point. PTSD was fueled because people lose your head when you're getting told time and time again you've done it wrong.
And you know damn well you did.
And you didn't. Yeah. But you do sometimes question yourself, have I done it wrong? And it's unfair. Especially at such like young age when I've gone out there to defend, serve and protect this great country. Mm. You know, I'm so passionate about this country, and I just couldn't believe what was happening. And you know, things, dark things started opening up, really fresh wounds were opening up, and
it's a scab scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going off the beaten track, which I then needed to get a purpose, and I needed to find and fix myself some purposes, which I did. I'm a football player, so I've done coaching, and then took the kids coaching courses. You know, I went away and done loads of charity events, and not too long ago cycled across America, actually 3,000 miles, just to sort of get out there and do something and raise some well-needed funds for veterans and stuff, which my headspace was just, to be honest, all over the place. And so when these allegations came out, you know, we just
and they weren't shot down by the army immediately.
No.
They were saying like, that's ridiculous. Don't be silly. They were like, let's see what's up. And that's the thing that, like, as a vet, and I'm, you know, my kids are British.
Yeah.
They're born here. My wife's British. So I consider myself part British.
Yeah.
Right? I love this country too. And I find it infuriating and frustrating at the same time. And I'm just reading this. You know what I'm saying? To be involved in this must have been maddening.
Yeah, it was demanding. And like I said,
that's a good way to put it, man.
It was a demanding process. And it was a demanding 10 years because it did take 10 years to then get the verdict. But so this was happening. These allegations were out there. I was then in with the solicitors. You know, I had a file case of, you know, over 400 pages. It was like you're in meetings after interviews, after meetings, after interviews,
shit like that.
Yeah, then it was my turn to go to court. Like, and I've not been a goody two-shoes my whole life, but I've never been to court, right? And,
especially, yeah. You're still in the military at this point, right?
Yeah. So I've still went out and done two operational tours after this had happened. So my name was in question, but they still allowed me to go off operational to another tour of Iraq and then in Afghanistan. So, you know, I did that because I believed in my regiment.
Mm-hmm.
You're
a good man, and these I don't mean to interrupt, but this guy, I just want to get a better picture of who this dude is that was allowed to bring these charges, unfounding charges against all of you guys.
So it's Phil Shiner. He's a human rights lawyer, so you know, he'll go in and investigate if there was any sort of mistreatment within different areas of operations for these Iraqis or Afghanis. You know, they'll go and do whatever they do. I don't even know in detail what they do, but there's some human rights.
You know, the Nazis had a human rights branch too. I imagine this guy goes there and looks for issues.
Yeah.
Looks for problems. And obviously anybody who's related to those guys that were fighting against you probably had a bunch of stories to tell, right? So it's all one side.
And he also, once it all came out, he was paying middlemen bungs of money to come up with false allegations. Course, and do you know what, right? This is a true story. They tried it with the Americans. They shut it down. They were too tight. Their system was all over it. They were like, not a chance. You're not getting in. That is not even going to get looked at. So what they did was they got the American or the militia claims that the American soldiers, what they said they did. They said they transferred it into British allegations.
Really?
Yeah, because they knew there were flaws in our system and they could carry it through. Because the American system was so tight, they said, oh, don't worry about that. We'll just use it as a British allegation so we can...
And there were no American troops anywhere near you?
No.
Yeah.
They were just coming up with false allegations just for money. Because he was deemed, Phil Shiner was deemed...
He's with a big suitcase of money handing out to people coming up with stories. Yeah. That's bullshit.
Yeah, I know. And he was deemed, though, to be one of the most superior lawyers in his field. He was an ambassador.
The Lord's General, kind of.
He was an ambassador. He was an ambassador for universities and colleges. And, you know, that's why the MOD probably give him that job, because he was meant to be the
cream. So he's working at the MOD?
The MOD must have. Do you know what? You can't quote me on that because I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, but he was hired by someone,
charges,
and he
right?
brought this these charges to get looked into. And like I said, I went in the courtroom. And
speaking of, you said you had sleepless nights. How does this motherfucker sleep at night doing this kind of shit?
Crazy.
That's
shit.
Unbelievable, man.
So I went into the courtroom, and because it was a public inquiry, this courtroom was stacked full of people. And they had their mirror glass where you can see out, but you can't see in. And I was like, shit, and there's screens everywhere. And it was really intimidated me. And I was like, bloody hell, really nervous. I've gone in there. The judge, Sir Thane Forbes, was legendary. Yeah. He was a good guy, man. Yeah. And he made me feel really at ease, because it was really intimidating. And then Phil Shiner was the sort of my 1 o'clock. And his representation stood up and started off, bang. Cross-examining me, bringing up all different slides on, because I had two screens in front of me. He'd bring up a couple of photos that were taken on the battlefield, and he was grilling me on them, saying that there were trophy photographs, and, you know, why was there blood on someone's hand would be beating these people, and you know, and I was like,
it seems like they're just fishing, right?
They just don't know. They've got no credibility. Yeah. They've not served this great country. I mean, he was like going wild on all these questions and on my statement and stuff, and I was trying to counter what I believed and
people were yelling at his dummy.
Yeah, of course. The people which
trying to keep your military
bearing. Yeah, I was just trying to be disciplined and keep my emotions intact, because I didn't want to show a sign of me getting agitated, because they were looking for that. And I was in there for about 40 minutes, and it sort of my sitting came to an end. But he said, he summarised with, "Brian, I believe in 2004, innocent civilians were killed that day." So he's basically called me a murderer in this courtroom in front of all these people. And I'd been through 10 years of hurt.
And combat operations too.
And been on a number of combat operations after all of this came out. So I'm stood there and I'm thinking, no. And I've opened my mouth, and the judge said to me, "We're done." I said, "Sir, I cannot leave this courtroom on that summary. It's unfair for you to allow that to happen, because I've been dragged through the mud and my fellow soldiers, my names have been tarnished. It's not fair." And he said, "Right, okay, on you go." So he let me.
That judge is pretty cool.
He's a cool dude. He knew the drill. Yeah. So I said to him, I stood up, and at this point I was emotional because of all built up on me. That's all right. At this point, I was emotional because I was, it just all seemed to just flood out. I kept it in for so long. And I said to him, "The QC, you have got no credibility to me. You haven't walked a yard in my shoes. You haven't signed up and fought for this great country. You haven't had to make split-second decisions in extreme circumstances to get it right. You haven't had to lay two fellow soldiers, brothers, to rest. You haven't gone through an absolute issue with relationship building. You haven't had distress in your name in public lights like I have. And you're calling me a murderer." I said, "If we continue to do this, we will cause a massive issue with decision making on the front line, because people will not make the right decision because they'll be like here with me. They'll be in front of a courtroom like this, and it's unfair. It's unfair, and it's a pack of lies." And at this point, I was like, tears streaming down my face, and then the judge was brilliant. He was like, "Brian," well said, "right, you can go." And then I left, and then in this year. Beginning of this year, he was Phil Shiner was found guilty of deliberate lies, no integrity. He was made bank. He made him declared himself bankrupt because he knew he was going to go
sue his ass.
And
this shit he did.
But we couldn't even sue him because he put his money in. Declared him bankrupt.
He's a lawyer.
He knows what he's doing. 100%. He knew exactly what he was doing. And it all came out in the press, and that's when I then broke my silence and went on national TV and spoke about this and the demand it had on me and my fellow soldiers for the last 10 years. And it just really hurts me how we've got systems that allow this to happen. And I do feel a little bit double-crossed with my government and the MOD to a degree. I love my regiment, and I'm passionate about my regiment, and I fought hard with the bravest of men within my regiment. But the MOD and the government knew what we were going through, and one phone call I had...
Really? No one just saying, "Hey, Brian, keep it up, doing good, keep it together"?
The only people I spoke to were people who were going through the heartache with me, because they knew how I was feeling, and I knew how they were feeling. I never had anyone external ask me how my family was, how my son was, how my other son was, because now, you know, I've got two kids now. And it was just such a difficult time in need as well. Like, my back was against the wall. And when I needed the support, I just, nothing, nothing was given to us, which is a regret of mine. I mean, you know, it is what it is now. I've just got to get on with it. But when I do look at it, I just think it's a little bit betrayed there, because I've fought hard.
Yeah.
And then when I need to fight back, no one's around me and helping me.
Do you think the situation is getting better in this country for that? I mean, with a lot of, I think recently Prince Harry, who's another combat vet, started talking about mental health issues within the MOD.
Yeah.
And it's something that a lot of the rank and file soldiers, airmen, Marines, Navy guys, sailors, were talking about amongst themselves in small groups. And it's now a big thing. Is that something you think it pulls you know, the sheet off of that, so the MOD has to take this all into consideration, how they behave? Because it seems, from an outsider, that the MOD would be more likely to believe someone like this guy, this lawyer, and his crazy cracked up stories than trusted men who serve this country. And it just seems to me that the balance is off. You know, they always see the scale of justice. You know, it seemed like it was really skewed in this guy's favor. And when you guys had to, well, all of you guys had to kind of defend your actions that day, that was already documented. And the fact that you couldn't have a conspiracy with like 90 guys in it, it just didn't make any sense. And I think now, do you think this thing happening with the MOD and Prince Harry will let the public know? Because essentially the public can say to, you know, to the MOD, because they do serve the public, like, hey, you got to treat these guys better. These are our guys. These are the guys that go do the shit that most people wouldn't even think of doing because they're too busy with their cell phones and, you know, some stupid soap opera. You know what I mean? It seems like the priorities were wrong. Do you think they're shifting?
I think Prince Harry has done a remarkable job. I mean, but why is it taking a figure like him to get traction? I mean, they've got to believe the people, the grunts will go and do this.
It seems like no one ever believes the grunts, man. You know, it's like, I mean, you could shout it from the rooftops, and then, like, I admire Prince Harry. I think he's doing good shit.
Yeah.
And I think him saying it is probably a result of him hearing it from all these guys. But still, why didn't it have to take that guy to do that?
Of course. And I've got so much respect for Prince Harry. Look, he's a leader of men. He's got some incredible values, you know. Yes, he's been a lad, but we're all entitled to that, right?
Yeah,
he's fought for his country.
When he could have
he's chosen a different path, and he went into some serious situations as well. So
you've got to give him, right? Absolutely. Did that one little trip, and then, you know,
definitely twice. You know, he went and put his neck on the line, which is incredible considering, you know, where he is in the chain of command. I mean, hats off to him. And he has to, but the Invictus Games, you know, what he does and push that forward, because these people are the 1% outstanding people within the country. They really are. 100% fact. When you put your neck on the line for your country, you are deemed in the top 1%.
Yeah.
And he knows that, and he looks after these people, and you've got to, because it's only right to do so. Have we got it right? We haven't. Are we getting it better? I think we are. Mm. With people like Heads Together, that foundation that he's in with the mental health, with the campaign that, you know, it's got some great traction with Trevor Colt.
I'm doing something with the criminals, but I nominated Frank Fass, man.
Brilliant. I mean, it's incredible. You know, that the likes of him, who's experienced the post-traumatic stress, who's now better and at the other end, and there is such a need for it. You know, him doing Walk a Mile in My Shoes, you know, little things which have gained so much traction is incredible, and that's a credit to him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a military cross winner himself. Yeah. You know, put his neck on the line for this country, and his passion to help others, it's inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to get around these sort of people, because there is a massive, massive job to do to try and help get these organisations in place, because there's a big stigma. We have to try and get out of it. It took me 10 years to go and see someone, if I'm honest.
It took me many, many, many years. Probably
2012, when I was at the when I was instructing with the Royal Marines, I was an instructor as a colour sergeant.
Mm.
It was actually a Royal Marine who said to me, a colour sergeant Royal Marine said, Woody, you've got to go and see someone, mate. You really have. And he walked to the door and then knocked on the door and then left me And that was my first, and it was 10 years too late. Yeah. And I wish I'd done it sooner.
But you did it.
But I did it.
But you did it.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I still did it. Yeah. And, you know, if I can, when I do public speaking or speak to some sporting organisations, when I open up and speak about, you know, sort of, my lessons learned and what I didn't get it right. So you should try and get it right because, you know, it only causes hurt and pain. And then when they hear people who have gone through a lot of sort of trauma in their life, they actually think, fair play, you've opened up. Well, and it's, yeah, you've done it, so I should...
Yeah, it's almost like the footsteps before them, you know what I mean? And standing on the shoulders of giants, it's a British phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that things are getting better and things like that. But, you know, it doesn't lend itself to much patriotism when people who are patriotic are patriots like yourself, heroes like yourself, who do these incredible things that most people won't do, and they get their integrity and their honesty is questioned by people who haven't. You know, and then when, you know, it turns out 10 years later, this guy's discredited and he's like rolling around wherever he's rolling around. And there's still people out there who, you know, have a negative view of the armed forces, actually a negative view of their own country because of the way the media portrays it all the time.
Yeah.
It's sad, man. I mean, because of a country, if you hate your country, will you defend it?
I know.
That's the thing that always bothered me as a guy who served. I was young when I went in, and it instilled in me a love for freedom and liberty and the things 100%. that, like, you know, we walk down the street and, you know, you've been to some bad places in the world where women can't even walk down the street by themselves,
of course,
for a myriad of reasons. Yeah. But, you know, we come back to the world, as we call it, right? You come back and it's like, oh, all this stuff's going on, but no one really is taking into consideration how it's afforded.
I know.
You know, that's the sad part, I think, that people, that's why I do these podcasts. I talk to guys like yourself. And,
yeah.
Because I think people need to know that, you know, by the grace of God, go them. Because, you know, a lot of people could have decided that, you know, they wanted to join the army and would have been in your shoes. And then they hear your story, like, shit, I don't know if I could have done that. And then they have more respect for the people who have done it rather than, in the United States, there's a class thing. And the people who usually join the military are kind of like the lower classes, right? And I'm talking about enlisted class, not the officer class. That's something different. It's college dudes or whatever. And it was always like guys from the Midwest who joined the Navy because they never saw the ocean before, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was like guys from New York who joined the Marines because the Army, they were tougher than the Army, whatever, kind of stupid shit like that. But within, when you look at it, like with the relief of this whole, I don't mean to get classy with my words, but you know, people talk about postmodernism where they destruct everything, like every construct, you know, like be it loyalty, integrity, honor, the things that, as soldiers,
core values.
Yeah, there are core values, and when you say that they don't exist, then it kind of lends itself to the next generation not having those values, and that's what I'm scared for. Because you got kids, I got kids. You know, I don't want them growing up in a world that is devoid of these values. You know?
Yeah, I totally understand and respect that. I really do.
And you got boys too. I mean, the whole thing. And I don't mean to go off track too much, but you hear how. When you hear about masculinity being attacked, like everybody, you know, you can't be an alpha male, it's bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it was for alpha males, no one would get anything done. There'd be a bunch of guys going, what do we do? So if you look at like the old Roman Empire, you know, like they fell because they decided that, you know, they were going to be very nihilistic. And I think that's how we're aiming towards. But it's like guys like you and
many others, guys like you. You know, and guys, there is plenty of natural leaders and people care out there, and we just need to keep a hold of that because it's so important for that. Because we need to keep punching on. It's so important. And like, you know, one of my proudest moments of my life was going to Buckingham Palace.
But
we never speak about it because of everything so overshadowed it. I went, you know, going to Buckingham Palace, my wife and my mum and dad, you know.
They must have been so proud of you then.
Oh, it was an unbelievable day, but
that happened soon after
2005. Literally put the medal on my chest and said, you know, this military cross, every time you wear it with pride. It's not very often I get to do this.
to a live person too.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a credit to you and the family, and thank you for your service. And that coming from the Queen was incredible. But like I said, I just very rarely talk about it now, unfortunately. Hopefully in time I will speak about it a little bit more. But because of everything else, it's just overshadowed it. It's just become sort of in the back burner, really.
Well, it's something that you have in your heart that can't get taken away.
Absolutely.
And, you know the military cross, and you know probably better than most, is a medal that's given for extreme bravery in combat.
Yeah.
And it's not just for shooting enough guys, or it's not just for, you know, being reckless. It's for all the other things. It's not that. You know, it's about keeping your guys together. It's about having the presence of mind to do the things you did.
Yeah.
And leading men. Because if no one's leading, who's going to follow?
Yeah.
You know, I think as time goes by, more people will start to understand that those certain things that make this country great are in the people of this country.
I think you absolutely nailed it there. I honestly believe that.
They're not things, they're people. They're living values that are alive. And that's the...
There's too many people get involved in things and decision-making. And, you know, I get that we have to have government, so I understand that. But we're given, you know, politicians have got key influences on decision-making, what happens with the military, when they've not served and been out on the front line themselves. Mm-hmm. But they're making key decisions, but not experienced it. They haven't got, you know... They don't understand the culture, the ground control, you know, what we do on operations day to day. But they're making key decisions, which you have to, of course, go along with, whether you believe it's the right thing or not, because we're soldiers and we have to get on with our job.
It's split-second decision-making. I mean, there was that Sergeant Blackman, the Royal Marine, who
they
put him in jail for 7 years, four and a half, whatever it was.
Absolutely.
And that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, the problem was initially, and I don't mean to say that body cams in combat are a bad thing, but they're not a good thing, because it makes you second-guess every instinct that you've been trained to do. And I'm not saying that this guy who was shot and wounded and then killed because he was shooting at his guys. That's not what I'm talking about. That actual thing. I'm just thinking that we have to remember that the people of this country are the ones that instill these values that we hold so dear.
Definitely.
Yeah, I appreciate you hanging with me, though.
Yeah, honestly.
You're going to come to the gig in May?
Oh, I'd love to.
Bring your boys?
I really would. Yeah, I mean, that would be special.
Two nights in Amsterdam.
And I'm just, before I go, I just want to quickly do a shout out to Trevor.
Oh yeah, man.
And you know, if you are listening today, it's really important that we get behind his campaign. It's Walk a Mile in My Shoes, and Huey's been on the back of it. He's jumped on and he's really supported it. So if you would like to walk a mile in my shoes, and text VIAS to 700700.
Dude, you remembered that.
I love that.
He didn't look at anything.
I'm all over that. You know, that's cool.
What do you know?
He's very passionate about it. Just if you're on social media, give him a little follow. Trevor Colt, was awarded the military cross, like I said earlier. It's incredible bravery, incredible man. And he's really, really making a difference with this campaign. So thanks very much, Huey, for having me here today. It's been my honor.
It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you, man. And I think it's great to see a lot of you guys from different branches, different regiments, all getting together for a good cause. I think it's good. And people should know that, you know, freedom isn't free.
Yeah. God bless you.
Man, bless you, bro.
Thanks,
I appreciate you doing this, man. Right on.
Dude.
That's a pretty heavy story, huh? Well, I'm happy to be able to share these experiences on the pod. I think it's really important to have these first-hand accounts out there, especially for my civilians. You can never really know the price of freedom until you hear a man like Brian speak about everything he went through to get it for you. Okay, so right now we're still playing with the schedule, so I can't really tell you exactly what's up next because I'm trying to make it good. I'm not just trying to give you a whole bunch of nonsense. I want it to count. So I can tell you it'll only be more dopeness, though, G. So now's the drill. Be sure to subscribe, spread the love. It's the Brooklyn Way. Leave us some nice reviews, iTunes, Acast. Thank you very much. And until next time, y'all stay classy.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.